Welcome to the screening. Today's screening will be Dune, Part 2. Back to the screening. I'm of course your eloquent host Cooper Cobbs. I'm joined today by two familiar faces and two unfamiliar faces. Maybe over there we got Mr. Tanner Lewis. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing well, thank you for asking.
And over, of course, we got Mr. Bryson Bostwick joining us.
Hey everybody.
And then we have a new face, Mr. Jack Truly, joining the podcast for the first time. Welcome, Jack.
Hello the screening fans.
Returning for a second episode, Mr. Todd Truly.
Yeah, I'm back. It's good to be back.
By popular demand. We are so glad that all of you guys have decided to join us today. We're going to be doing a mega episode on Dune Part 2. So, guys, I guess just first off, I guess we can start with you, Bryson. What was your just first impression walking out of the theater seeing Dune Part 2? I don't want to give us history of, like, how you first came to know Dune, the first movie as well. What was just your first time experience and what you brought to it?
Yeah, okay. So, out of everybody, I probably have the least experience with Dune, for sure. I think the first time I heard about it was, like, when I first started seeing trailers of the first movie. That was the first time I'd ever heard of Dune. It seemed kind of interesting to me, the whole concept of just having a out-of-this-world experience where all the planets were centered around this trade of spice and main planet being a desert planet. Sounded interesting, but wasn't really something that I thought I needed to spend much time on. So then I actually had no desire really to want to do any of that until I think trailers for the second movie started coming out, and I was like, oh, okay, this is actually interesting now. And lo and behold, come to find out that, like, it's split into two, the first book is split into two movies, and so the climax of the book, or the exciting part of the book, happens in the second movie. And I'm like, oh, okay, now I'm actually interested. So then went to see the movie with friends, because I knew we were all probably going to go see it at some point. And So then, yeah, ended up seeing the movies, and now I'm here to talk about it.
And what is your take? If you had to summarize, like, your position on the movie in, like, one sentence, what would you say?
Definitely nothing I've ever seen before, for sure. But really, really entertaining, and something that I was pleasantly surprised to see, for sure.
Nice. All right, well, Todd, move to you. I mean, same kind of question. What were your history and experiences with Dune, and then what were your first thoughts when you saw Dune Part 2? I mean, I was sitting next to you the whole time, so that was really fun to see. But
yeah, so let's say, well, around the time the first one came out, it's a Friday. I think I'm going to go home and just spend my time on the couch on a Friday night after CC.
Classic Todd.
And my mom tells me that our father is going to take us to a movie. And I was like, what movie? And she said, Dune. I was like, I kind of knew what it was, but I had no idea really what I was about to experience. So he takes our family to go see it in IMAX, as it should be, as the first and second shouldn't be seen. I had the best theater experience I've ever had in my life. And that inspired me to go read the book, because I had to know what happened. And after I read the book, coming into this second one, I was expecting another great experience, which I had. It was even better than the first one. I had a better theater experience than I did for the first one. But I did have my worries about after I read the second half of the book. I thought, how are they going to do this? So that was my baggage.
Nice. And if you just want to summarize again, like, your position, I know, like, right after the movie ended, you, like, ranked it first on your movies you had seen recently. So,
okay.
Like, what motivated you to do that?
I'd say it's an entertaining masterpiece, technically brilliant, with a couple nitpicks story-wise, but altogether very good. 5 stars.
Nice. All right. So, Jack, I know you're kind of like Bryson. You had not read the book, not really had any exposure to it coming into Dune Part 2. What was your history, and then what was your take, your position on the movie?
So, yeah, Dune, we watched it, like Todd said, IMAX. After the first one, I'm a stickler for story beats and resolution. And after the first one, I was like, I could have cared less and literally hated it. I was like, that was awful.
So what was the ride home like then if Todd was like bouncing in his seat, like giddy?
Yeah, let's be completely honest here. We were complete opposite leaving that. Jack was frustrated and I was inspired.
Lots of argumentation, but good CC, classically educated homeschool boy. Argumentation happened.
Absolutely.
So coming into the second one, I was like, yeah, I guess I care. I didn't read the book. I probably never will. But
we're reading the second one now. We're reading Dune Messiah.
True. Todd's reading Dune Messiah.
I ordered it.
That's so cute.
I know. Yeah. I like how you said.
Jack's my chauffeur. He drives me everywhere. And so I'm in the passenger seat. And we're reading Dune Messiah. The first book we read together in the car was The Sun Also Rises, Hemingway. Nice. And now we're on Dune Messiah.
That's awesome. Yeah, go keep going, Jack.
Yeah, so first one, pretty much hated it. And I've only watched the first one twice.
Okay, and did you see it like right before the second movie came out again?
Yes, okay. We watched it at home because Todd bought it on DVD because he liked it. So
Blu-ray.
Going into the second one, I was like, this will be fun. I want to do the screening podcast with the boys. So let's see how it goes. I didn't have any expectations. And then I was just absolutely blown away coming out of the second one. Incredible story. I mean, if that's my little thing that I say real fast. Incredible story.
I know you said you came out of the theater and you said, I think I know how I'd fix the first movie now. Is that what you said?
That's true.
In terms of story? Okay, I really want to hear that later on. But real quick, Tanner, what were your thoughts, your history, that kind of thing for the folks?
So I guess the first thing is, out of all of us here, I'm the only one who read the books before we watched the movies. And so I guess I kind of have that leading into a lot of my history with these. So I remember that Cooper had come out of watching the first Dune movie, and he's like, oh man, this first Dune movie was really good. And I'm like, oh great. And he's like, but there's a book on it. And I'm like, oh, I need to go read the book first. So I go in and I read the book, and I love the book, just absolutely adore it. And so I read the book, and I love that. And Cooper and one of our other friends, Isaiah, comes over as well. And we watch that, the first Dune movie. And to be honest, the first one kind of left me a little bit disappointed. Just didn't give me the same kick that the books did. So it's kind of where I left off with that first movie. But then when I moved to the second movie this year, I was really hyped for it, just because I saw a lot of potential for what it could be from the books. Just there wasn't as much need for the dream parts as much in this part, and I believe they did that really well in this movie. So I guess where I landed with these and where my history landed with them is just that there was so much that I wanted to see in the books the first time that I watched it, because I watched this with Bryson for my first time, and then I watched it a second time with you guys. And as I watched it the second time was just so much better than the first, just because I didn't really understand a lot of the things that Villeneuve said. And so that just kind of led to, I didn't really know where I wanted him. I didn't really like the way that he took it at the climax originally. But watching it the second time around, I definitely got where he was coming from and why he did what he did.
Now, seriously, I was defending the movie to Tanner. Tanner saw the movie, and then he became like a passionate apologist. And I was like, Tanner, I agree with your past self now, like a lot. And he was like, no. Current Tanner is defending the movie. So my stuff is just, I've read the book, I saw the movie, I was really excited for this movie. I knew it was going to like be this huge blockbuster, incredible spectacle. And obviously, like, it is a cinematic experience, like sitting in the theater in IMAX watching it. Like, it's awesome. And I had used the bathroom the first time I saw it because, you know, bladder stuff. And then there's a sandworm scene where he rides a sandworm. And I was like, I could go use the bathroom now. This has been on YouTube for a while. I've seen this clip on YouTube. No, I had to stay and watch it in the theater. And I made the right decision and set up the whole movie with a full bladder. But it was worth it. And it was a big spectacle. And the special effects were awesome. And everything about it was just a cinema. You know what I mean? Like, this is cinema, that kind of thing. And I really wanted to find something to not like about it so I could be cool and different from the 95% of people who gave it a thumbs up on Rotten Tomatoes. So this podcast will be my best go at that. But I think that, I mean, obviously, like, it's a fun movie that's incredibly well made and is a joy to watch in the theater. So that's my thoughts. But go ahead, Tanner.
So this gets us into the first time that I saw it. And the first time that I saw it, I think the number one reason that I didn't like it was the relationship between Paul and Chani.
Hang on. Rewind. Chani.
Did you say Chani? Hey, my dad called them the Freeman today. The Freeman.
Wow.
Or Chani. And their relationship, it just didn't seem believable. It was almost like, I don't know, it felt rushed, it felt forced, and, like, we had the intimate scene, but, like, it just didn't need to be there, right? Like,
what do you mean by that? What do you mean? Wait. Okay. Get past that scene.
Everything that happened between Paul and Chani just was, like, it felt so forced, and I really didn't like it the first time that I saw it. And I didn't really understand why it had to be so quick and like why their relationship had to be like so up and go so quickly until I saw it the second time. And when I saw it the second time and I paid a little bit more attention to kind of the interaction between the characters and, you know, what's supposed to happen, what's not supposed to happen, I just kind of felt like I saw it from Villeneuve's perspective
so much more. It's Denis Villeneuve.
There you go.
Fluent French. Oui, oui,
Canadian?
Oui, oui, baguette croissant.
He is Canadian. But
that's what I thought. Yeah, he's Canadian.
I saw, like, the amount of things that he had to get done and how he, like, couldn't do a long timeline, right? Mainly because he had to keep Aaliyah in, Paul's sister, Aaliyah, in Jessica's womb for the entire movie, which I know makes sense. And I'll go more into this in my Tanner's rant that I'm going to do about this specific subset about Aaliyah, his sister, in a later time in my Tanner's rants. But, like, just for us right now, I think the main thing that I just couldn't get over was I couldn't get over just the forcedness of it. And while I still don't like it as much, I think it's, like, I don't think it's as believable. I can see why it needed to be there, right? It just felt like it was needed to be like that.
I can't wait to disagree with this.
Okay, go ahead, Todd. Jump in.
I don't know. It's like, here's my reasons for believing it. I believed in it. It's when it first starts. I think what sells it is the cinematography and music. In the beginning, it's
Bryce
the music.
And I were like, wait,
yeah, that was really
weird. Cinematography
was driving
No. In the beginning of their, like, oh, they're falling in love. Like, when she's showing him to do this thing, but then, like, her voice fades out, and then it's just music and him staring at her. That's when I believed it.
It juggles, like, and that was the moment I was like, this is,
yeah,
not
that was
working
the moment
at all.
I was like, this is, no.
I'm gonna be the odd one out, but it felt natural to me. Just to clarify, Cooper can confirm this. I said, can I go to the restroom now during that intimate scene?
No, that's not true. That was not that scene. It was the scene where he was talking to Jessica before she left for the South,
I said,
right?
But when it, that's right after that.
Oh, is it?
And I'm
sorry.
And I said, is now a good time to go to the restroom?
It is a good time. I was like, yes, son. I mean, Todd, yes, cover your eyes and go to the bathroom. Okay, so Jack and I were talking about that, though. Like, it seems rushed, but also The Princess Bride has, like, 5 minutes of film time between Wesley and Buttercup, and then, like, we totally buy it. Like, we're in. You know what I mean?
Yeah, as you wish.
Exactly. Yes. So, like, is it just, like, why does it not work? Like, so for me, when I saw it, I was like, look, there are two attractive people who have charisma, Timothy Chalamet and Zendaya. Like, it kind of works.
He uses desert rizz.
But then as I started thinking about it more, I'm like, yeah, I'm not really sure I buy a lot what's going on here. But at the same time, I was like, why does this, like, not work as well when The Princess Bride does? I don't know. Jack, do you have anything to bring to that? Like, what are your thoughts when you're, like, analyzing the relationship?
I mean, I haven't rewatched The Princess Bride, but yeah, it's so true. It's like, how come that works? I don't think I have anything particular. It's just, yeah, it just seemed so rushed. It was like, oh, they're talking on a sand dune. Oh, they're in a tent together now. Oh, this is escalating quickly.
Here's where I land with The Princess Bride thing, right? Like, why do we believe it in The Princess Bride and we don't believe it here despite the 5 minutes thing, right? I think the number one thing, it lands to comedy, right? Like, there's a, like, comedy forces us to love certain things. And I just think that specifically...
So you're saying like, it takes more like a wink and a nod approach to it than Dune is, so self-serious.
Certainly. Like, because it's so self-serious, it wants you to take it seriously, right? Whereas for Wesley and Buttercup, it's like 5 minutes in, and you're like, oh, this is hilarious, right? Like, you believe it, but you believe it because it's funny, right? It's not, oh my gosh, they're desperately in love and they're going to get married. It's like, oh my gosh, they're desperately in love and going to get married because of As You Wish, right? You're going to laugh.
Mm. Yeah, actually, that plus, like, the whole movie is literally them trying to get back together. Trying to find each other the whole movie.
Yeah, but let's not forget, Paul was already in love with her. Like, because of his visions and dreams, he was already in love with her. So he only had to use his desert rizz to woo her.
Activate.
So it's not the believability of them falling in love.
Is this Calvinism right here?
He
was predestined.
She's already in love with him.
And he just needed the wooing of the Holy Spirit.
I guess I'm a little biased because I was like, having read the book already, is like, this is supposed to happen, so I have to believe it. So I already believe it from reading the book, so that may have bleeded in through
the movie. For me, like, since I hadn't read the book, I didn't know, okay, do they end up together? Is there a falling out? And so kind of as it progressed and went along, and they started becoming closer together and then also falling apart and not really sharing each other's same dreams, same goals. Near the end, I was like, oh, wait. So, yeah, because I'm like you, Todd. I kind of had bought into it at the beginning, just started believing that this actually was going to work. And then since I hadn't read the book, I was like, oh, wait. So this is not going to work, apparently. And just this life-giving blood from the worms has taken away every desire he has to be with her. And, yeah, that kind of crushed my soul at the end.
Yeah. It's kind of a bummer at the end, too, especially when he says, like, she'll come around. I don't really believe that at all. Like, even the first time I saw it, when I kind of bought it, I was like, I don't...
Yeah, and I think they did a really poor job, once again, as I said earlier in the movie, of, like, displaying what actually happened between Chani and Paul. Like, Chani and Paul were together throughout the entire thing, right? And, like, they had some bonding moments that had taken place throughout the book that like their son had died at the end. And so, like, the very end part, you never really questioned whether Paul and Chani, like, would still be together throughout Princess Irulan, right? Like, you knew that they were going to be together because they'd had all of those intimate moments. Mm-hmm. And just, like, it naturally led there.
But those were exactly my worries, though. Like, how are they going to do this? And I think he did it the best way you possibly have could. He did it the best way it could for the movie sake. So. Yeah.
Okay, first, I want to talk about Todd. At the very beginning, you said, like, the cinematography and music sells it for me. And I was thinking to myself the entire time, but Across the Stars is, like, the best love theme of all time. And it couldn't get me to buy like Padme and Anakin, you know what I mean? And so, I don't know, like...
but I bought Padme and Anakin.
And therein lies the problem. Okay. All right, well, so it seems like most people online agree that Timothée Chalamet had a better performance in Dune Part 2. Would you guys agree with that?
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely. Easily. Hands. Oh, well, it can't top him as Wonka. Oh, my goodness. That was such a good performance.
That fits his personality and just him as a character a whole lot better, I feel like.
Mm-hmm. I think he needed to make some... He needs to make spice melange chocolate.
So, Jack, for you, did Dune Part 2 working better than Part 1, is that at all due to Timothée Chalamet's improved performance? Did you care about him more in Part 2 or no?
No. I care about Paul... In both of the movies, I just, that character in particular didn't have it. I mean, Paul is what I like about the two movies. It's just, and I cared about him in both, and Timothée Chalamet's performance didn't really bother me in either one.
Okay. Hmm. Yeah, I think the only thing of note is that he grew up like really fast. And I like to joke, like the movie takes place like a couple hours later, and he's already got like a full mustache going on.
Yeah,
like,
what's he's got his stubble, which is only coming to him at age 28. He finally has his mustache.
Yeah, Timothée Chalamet.
Cooper
does,
knows
yeah.
exactly what that's like.
Hey, I shaved.
Oh, whoa.
Okay.
Whoa.
Sorry. It was just right there.
All right. Well, Timothée Chalamet, I mean, like he did like he did well in like taking on the more adult, somber, messianic, fervent tone of Dune Part 2 for sure. So I don't know if we can say much else there.
I'm going to guess great director.
Oh, yeah. I mean, directing.
Like Villeneuve is a great director. And
oh, my goodness, yes.
That is also probably what did it.
What added to it was just all of the aspects working together. The cinematography, the costume change, too. And then... he seemed more intimidating when he started using the Fremen language, actually. There is a difference. And his new theme, the
I guess anybody have any other thoughts on the other characters? Like Rebecca, she kind of became like this weird, I don't know, fanatic.
Yeah, she drank the juice and, well, things happened.
I know. She did really sell that, oh my goodness, now I'm a crazy lunatic and I can see the future and you better do what I say or we're going to lose everything. So yeah, I think she played her position really well. And I think, I mean, there weren't really any characters or any actors that I felt were really unbelievable or were hard to get behind.
Yo,
at least when it came to
Christopher Walken.
Yes, Christopher Walken. Christopher Walken.
I know. It doesn't bother me because I just don't have much of a connection to him. But I think, yeah, for everybody who like knew him like pretty well, then yeah, I'm sure that it was jarring. So
Dave Bautista. I don't think Dave Bautista did a great job either with his role.
Okay, I'll be honest. Dave Bautista just didn't get a lot to do, man. Like, I'll be honest. I really did not. One of the things I did not like was just how they handled him because he just became like this pathetic character, you know. Kissing Elvis.
Yeah, in the first
boots,
movie, I was excited to see this villain that he was going to become that was going to be terrifying and one of the main people that Paul had to go up against. But then, lo and behold,
the scariest
he's
scene
just
with him is in the first movie prologue when you just see him like walking with a whip on his hip and then like staring. That's the scariest he is.
So,
I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, okay. Anybody else have anything to say about characters? Austin Butler was a ton of fun.
Yeah. Stilgar was funny, but in a way that was not too forceful.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, let me talk about that because let me go talk about the continuity of the first film because my thought was when seeing these films back to back, Tara and I watched the first movie like the night before we went and saw Dune with you guys the next day. I thought to myself, it seems to me like they don't really know in this first movie who these characters are. Like, they're in a very superficial way, they're playing, like, the epic embodiments of Stilgar, the Dream Girl Zendaya. And now in the second movie, we have to, like, figure out who these characters are. And so, like, to me, that comes up with, like, continuity issues. It's like, is the Stilgar from this movie the same Stilgar as in the last movie? And I'd say largely
yes. I noticed that myself, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say largely yes, but then, like, I don't know. Did you guys ever feel like the comedy went too far from the character you saw in the first film, or do you just feel like you didn't have, like, a limited enough interaction in the first film with him to tell?
I don't know, yeah. That is part of the reason why the first film felt so bleh, just bland, I feel like, because, I mean, that makes sense. I didn't think that in the first place, but now that you say it, that is kind of what I believed, is that they didn't really know the direction they were going when they first started acting, and they didn't have, I don't know, it kind of felt like they didn't know the end of the story, and so they weren't acting like they knew what was coming next. And maybe, I don't know, maybe that's just the actual characters in the book, and I don't know. So, Todd and Cooper, since y'all have read the book, do y'all feel like they played their parts really well with the first half of the first movie, or in the first part of the book, just them being more confused? And I mean, Paul and Jessica are on this planet just in the middle of nowhere and have nothing to do except go with the Fremen. So I would think they have a little lack of direction. But yeah, that's another thing, is Paul all of a sudden is just like, okay, I am. That is something that I didn't really see a whole lot of, is he didn't show a lot of leadership capabilities or qualities in the first movie. And then all of a sudden he is just the manliest man and wanting to having all the ideas, having the right things to say, saying the right words to the Fremen, and just everything working out. So I don't know.
I think symbolically that change happens at the end of the first movie when Paul Atreides dies, that non-leader-like, and then the Kwidat's Hederach rises, and when he kills Yamis. I don't know. Yeah.
That did seem like the turning point moment when he killed.
Oh yeah, once he killed a man, I feel like, I guess there was a change.
I disagree with that. I think the change for Paul is when he's in the tent, and he, like, it's full circle. Right.
This is the first movie tent. I don't know what you're thinking of while you're laughing.
Yeah, first movie tent. First movie tent.
Not the sharing. It's not the sharing tent.
The tent in the first one
when he gets named.
No, when he gets he's stuck in the desert with his mom, and they're like, when the ship goes down, and
he sees it, like a big vision of
the big vision, and he's like squirming around and he's sweating a lot. That scene when
he's like, "You've been a Jesuit, made me a freak."
Yeah, that part. That for me, it was super convincing for him, and where I think the first movie should end. Is when he chooses to, that's where where he accepts that he's now the Duke and he has to take on that leadership role. Mm-hmm. That's where the change is for me. But the killing Yamis is really, I mean, it is symbolic of he's starting to get drawn into this lie, but that's what it is. He's getting drawn into the Fremen world, which will lead him onto this path of corruption as the messianic figure. Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily a path that he wants to go on, which is obviously explored a lot more in the second movie.
Mm-hmm.
So my thought coming out of the second movie was, I wish they could have filmed these back-to-back. And a lot of people are comparing this to, like, Two Towers. Lord of the Rings benefited from being able to film, like, back-to-back. You know, you can tell they're all pretty, like, continuous in terms of, like, small things and also big tonal things. And I think that there's, like, enough small discrepancies that is, like, bother me ever so slightly. I don't know about you guys. So, like, with Chani, she tells him in the first movie, "I don't think you're Lys on Al Gaib." The next movie, she's like, "I don't think there is a Lys on Al Gaib," you know? Like, it's one thing to tell Jesus, "I don't think you're God." Then, like, 2 seconds later, like, "I'm an atheist." You know what I mean? It's like,
that's how I feel like that's, now I finally understand the point that people are making when they say that.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I think that Dune Part 2 tried to correct a lot of things that were kind of like potential weaknesses of the first movie, but because they weren't filmed back-to-back, couldn't do it in like a continuous way. So like, for example, critique of the first movie, it's not very funny, you're so self-serious, The funniest line we get is like,
three
I am
times
smiling.
When it's kind of funny.
I know. But then the second movie, all of a sudden, Stilgar becomes like just comedic relief, you know? And so they kind of lighten that up. That kind of thing. Then second, we don't, Paul, you know, Timothy Chalamet doesn't give a good enough performance. Well, guess what? He improves his performance. Something like that. But so they realize that the first movie is kind of like this big, epic, broad movie. But like, really, there's not like a whole, like, there's not a ton of substance to who these characters are, especially the characters that are going to become big characters in the second movie. So like Stilgar and Shani, like, who are these characters? Like, we're not really sure. Like, Stilgar is the embodiment of the noble native chieftain. That's like who he is. That's just all he is. Zendaya is the girl from that perfume commercial, except in my dreams. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of who she is.
Cooper? Yeah, wait, what? Cooper?
And so when the second movie comes around, they have like 2 years, you know, in between the movies. I mean, maybe smaller in terms of filming. But like, they have to figure out who is Zendaya, who is Shani, you know, who is Stilgar, and then really develop that later on in the process. And so it kind of like looks different. I don't know. Anybody else see that? Is that just me? It's okay.
Yeah, that's partly why the second one is so much better.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah, it's not just a broad,
yeah, this is more of a lament than a critique.
View.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I
part
like,
one,
especially
part one's the rough draft.
Especially since I hadn't read the book, like I had no idea who we were following. Even like, okay, I knew we're following Paul, but besides him, I was like, okay, well, he keeps having visions of Zendaya, so apparently she's going to be in it too. And I don't know, for some reason, like I thought we were going to be following Jason Momoa and other characters like him, and then oh, well, he's gone, and no longer are we talking about him. So yeah, and then in the second movie is when we finally have more character development. And we find
just do it for part three, Bryson. Just do it for part three. Okay.
Yeah.
Only book readers know that. Okay.
I understood.
So let's talk about Okay, let's talk about Paul changing into the Messiah figure. So Jack, you talked about it kind of with like where you thought the end of part one should have been, then, you know, Paul becoming this more messianic figure later on, the kind of allure of that. So in the book, it's more of a natural, just kind of happens to him. And when it does, he's kind of like ready for it. He accepts it. In the movie, he's reluctant to assume the mantle. But then he just kind of like does it after he takes the water of life and becomes, you know, full on bad guy. I mean, not bad guy, but full on, you know, dark messiah kind of figure. So any guys want to take a stab at your thoughts on that arc? Did it work for you? Did you buy it? Is it a fall? Is it a rise? What's going on there? Jack, you want to go off? And then Bryson, do you?
Yeah. So I think I won't talk about the first movie a whole lot, but I think the first movie should have focused on just Paul accepting that he is the Duke of Arrakis and that he can do things for himself apart from other people. It should have focused on that, set up the second one, and then focused more on the becoming the Messiah in the second one. Leave that for the second one. Like, set that up, but don't focus on it. And it was, that's where the first one had a problem, where it was trying to focus on the two things at once. So that arc didn't feel, that's where the resolution problem the first one comes in. Then in the second one, it really explores, I think it's a fall arc. Well, I think it's a corruption arc, where it starts off with, he this is what Paul believes, and then he is drawn into this lie. He's kind of forced into this lie once he lives with the Fremen. He believes in honor, family, and he doesn't believe in needless bloodshed. And then he's drawn into this world of the Fremen where they believe in similar things like honor and family, but they have different feelings about bloodshed. And especially the Messiah figure has no regard for pointless bloodshed. It's just this seeking power at all costs. Paul's flaw is that he doesn't really trust himself and he's always looking for help anywhere he can find it, which I think is reflected in him relying on his mother, Stilgar, Chani, his dad, even Yamas in the, when he's like, what do I do, Yamas? And Yamas is like, go drink the water of life. And then that's when it finally, he drinks the water of life and I don't think that's just he makes those decisions simply. I think it's really judging what he believes about things like morality and bloodshed. And it takes him away from that belief, especially that morality, which is very compelling.
Yeah, because you see it in the his vision of the Atomics blowing up and then Chani with, like, burnt-up face.
Leprosy
and his
kind of.
Yeah.
Terminator 2.
Well, it actually looked like a part of Oppenheimer, but I don't know if you guys got that reference. Yeah.
Okay, so Jack, would you have ended the first movie, like, after the tent? Or would you have just, like, done more to set up and pay off the Dukal arc and then, like, introduced, like, the setup for the next movie at the very end?
So I would have personally switched the Duncan Idaho stuff and the fleeing into the desert stuff. I would have saved the tent for the end. Mm-hmm. And it to be like the closing
that comes
thing.
Before the Duncan Idaho stuff, I guess, doesn't it?
Right. So, like, timeline wise, I would have switched those two things and made it so he has to progress to this. He's in the tent point. That was really I didn't like fully think about it, but those were the two things that I would have switched to make it more compelling, like a more compelling arc, and also not make me be like, all right, when's this going to be over? Because after the tent thing happens in my mind, I'm like, all right, there he goes. He's the Duke now.
Right.
Let's get on with this. Where are we going? What's happening now? I feel like that would have helped compelled me to draw it out more. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah, that's one of the things I said to you was I think that filling these back-to-back would have given them a greater confidence in ending like that so they could know that they would be all right because the second movie was going to come out anyway. But when that's not coming out, you have to sell tickets. You have to ensure that people are going to want to come back. You have to do more to set up the next movie when it's unsure, I guess. So I agree with you. I think – so actually, the tent ends part one in Dune. Like it's the end of one of the three parts. Mm. And so it's like a natural breaking point already. And I agree with you. I think they tried to set that up in the beginning with the Dukal part, the Dukal ring, and what if I'm not ready? And just kind of didn't really, nail that, I think. So I agree with you. I think the ending is already awkward and boring, like any way you look at it, in terms of like a storytelling perspective. So I think that's a good pitch to make it better. Anyway, Bryson, what about you? What do you think about Paul's arc in the second movie going to like from lovable guy to dark messiah? Any thoughts there?
Yeah, well, so y'all keep talking about his arc as the Duke, and like that's something that I almost completely forgot going into the second movie. It felt like it was such a okay, we're just gonna like bury that here and not really talk about it a whole lot in the first movie, and I was like, oh wait, so he's progressing first from this young boy that needs to become a man, that needs to become the Duke. Then, oh, okay, all of a sudden, now he's going to be the Messiah? Like, whoa, we just jumped a whole lot of space right there in his character progression as a man. And, yeah, so I didn't see a whole lot of that. Okay, now he's becoming the Duke. Okay, now he is becoming the Messiah. And, I mean, I guess we do see towards the end when he fights the Gnaw Baron, he finally is like, okay, yes, that is the highest title I have right now is I am the Duke of Arrakis. Mm. And we finally do see, okay, he is one and the same. He's both going to be Messiah to the Fremen and he's going to be the Duke of Arrakis. How is he going to make those play out and work together? But then I also have to say those were some of my favorite scenes from the movie is him finally being like, okay, I'm now going to be this people's Messiah. I'm now going to completely become this religious figure for them. Because I don't know. I wasn't really buying a whole lot of the Duke of Arrakis side.
Those were like the single best scenes from the movie.
Yes, easily the best scenes.
When he's in his arrival to the south before he like proves to everyone that he's the Lasan Agaib, with the like dark sand and then the sandworm coming out of the sand behind him and the music blasting him walking into the
crowd. Yeah, and then he enters into the the room that is definitely ripped off from A Bug's Life. That scene. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
That was one of the first things that Cooper and I said when we got out of the theater. We were like, was that just Bug's Life, right?
Confirmed.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I did love those parts though, and those were the scenes, I mean, besides some of the really well shot scenes, that I was like, okay, I can finally get behind this character. Not that I really want him to be the Messiah. I just want to see how he's going to go and progress from being Duke to being the Messiah to then being the Duke again, or being the Emperor, or just how the Messiah is going to be stepping stone to something else.
Let me ask you a follow-up question here, Bryson. Are we supposed to, like, track our relationship to Paul while this is happening, like, with Shani? Like, are we supposed to be on Shani's side? Are we rooting for Paul? Like, what's going on here? Like, where should our sympathies lie? Should we, like, lament Paul as he should have been? I don't know. What are your thoughts there?
For most of it, I was with Chani, and I was like, what is he doing? He's throwing everything away. He had found this life. But then I started realizing, okay, wait, so what is his purpose still? Who is he still trying to be? And then has the living water corrupted him and made him someone that he's not supposed to be? And I really think that it has. It has changed him for sure, and he is no longer the man that he was meant to be. He was proclaimed to be, and I did side with Shani for most of it and towards the end. And then actually I was like, okay, wait, so this is so very confusing. Tanner's like, okay, they ruined the whole ending of the book, so what do? We go home and we listen to the end of the book so that I have a full accurate knowledge of what actually happens in the end, and that Chani is still with him at the end. Yeah, yeah. And I was like, wait, like, he was supposed to be with Chani. What's going on here? Why are we all of a sudden concerned about the princess? And so, yeah, it did make sense, more sense after that. But I still was like, wait, okay, I clearly think that Chani is in the right here, and that even though she was this, okay, there is no Messiah figure, or you can't be the Messiah, I did still feel like he was taking it too far. But then I don't know if I can say exactly what his main goal is right now. And y'all can probably explain that better. What he was trying to accomplish by becoming the Messiah, the Zan al Ghaib. Like,
I think Bryson's observation makes me think of, like, because this is a tragedy, in my opinion.
If we get a third movie, it'll definitely be a tragedy. Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's a tragedy. It also makes me think of, like, his mom, after she drinks, like, her drinking the water of life is the catalyst for the whole second part.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And, like, after that point, she is, her goal, at least how it comes off to me, is she's trying to gain power for herself and her lineage. And she's going to do that through whatever means possible, even if that means exploiting her own son and preying on his flaw, which I think she does, because she knows that he doesn't believe in himself and he's going to seek direction wherever he can find it. And she exploits that, and she exploits the Fremen, which I think is the more obvious one. Go ahead, Tanner.
So I guess the biggest thing that we have to note here is just that in the book, like, it wasn't meant to be like that. Like, she was not trying to exploit anybody or do anything weird. It was honestly almost Paul exploiting her.
And I'm not saying that it does it like, it does that, in my opinion, it does, like, that very, like, super well.
Yeah, yeah, right. Exactly. Her exploiting everything. Yeah, I completely tracked her as the main cause
so
of everything that then happened.
Is she doing it? Okay, so Jack, you said that she's doing it for herself. Is she doing it?
Well,
like,
she's doing
for
it for
Paul?
Her lineage. She's doing it for Paul, and she's doing it for her daughter.
Yeah,
she's doing it for them, but through however she can. And I don't know.
Yeah, another thing is, in the book, she, like, her and Paul, like, Paul sees fragments of the truth.
Really?
And Jessica doesn't do that. She sees fragments of the truth after she drank the life water, but it's not the same thing as Paul after he had the life water. It was a different thing. So, like, Jessica could see fragments of the truth, just like Paul at that time could see fragments of truth. But after Paul drank the life water, like, they were on, Paul was far above her in all of the thoughts and stuff that he had, like, all of the prescience that he could see. And so, like, it just doesn't really sell that Jessica was the one that exploited him in the book, because really, Paul was just seeing everything and trying to do the best that he could to be able to, you know, steer them towards the right path. So I guess that's the biggest thing that I see there.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, but she's not the Kwisatz, she's not the Kwisatz Haderach quite yet. I mean, she's not close to that. I was going to say that, like, in the book, he drinks the water of life of his own volition. She actually has no idea what's going on. Like, they just discover him in a coma, and like, what's going on? So she is much less manipulative in the book. And then both she and Gurney in the movie just kind of come on as oppressive. And then I feel like Chani is supposed to be our moral center, but I really don't like that because I think she's annoying at the end. I don't know. Like, and I think they had to change it because in the book she is like very much just supportive, like in everything almost. She even is like willing to go away. Like at the end when she realizes that he's gonna have to marry Irulan, she's like, "Hey, can I just like leave now?" He's like, "No, I love you." So I don't know. Jack, are you gonna say something?
Yeah, I was gonna say how it's presented in the movie. If he's not being taken, if his flaw is not being taken advantage of, then for me the corruption arc does not work, because that's what sets it off. Like that's what takes him into that dark path. Is people manipulating him?
Wait, so do you think that Paul was like wrong, or that he was trying to like, I don't know, do something bad here? Like, was he supposed to be corrupt at the very end? Is that what kind of you saw?
Yeah, he took the dark path. I don't know, like, how he, like, think through, was there another way that he could have done it without taking the Messiah path? Like, could he have even beat them? Because, you know, the emperor and a lot of people are talking about how, like, oh, he's just another prophet. Like, does he have to be the Messiah in order to not just be another prophet? And then it goes back to the fate and destiny thing. That's like, does he have a choice in becoming the Messiah?
Wait, where were we? My curry. How do we make this flow?
Okay, guys, you know what? I'm just going to own up. Welcome to Dune part 2. We stopped our other recording, started a new one so that we could keep talking. We're talking about Paula's Messiah figure. Todd, you had something to say? Keep going. Todd said, what you say, Todd. Go ahead. Set up the conversation.
Frank Herbert wrote this, the first book, as a cautionary tale towards messianic figures. He was saying, Paul, it is a corruption arc, as Jack said. It is a fall. He becomes a anti-hero. It's not good, the outcome.
Confession, I love anti-heroes.
Okay,
stop you, Taylor Swift.
Tanner, you might say Tanner roots for them.
Okay, thanks.
Go ahead, Todd. Keep going.
So, does that prompt us to think that Frank Herbert, us as Christians, should we let it slide that he's saying that messianic figures are dangerous?
Okay.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, of course they are. Jesus was dangerous.
Whoa. In the worst of scenes.
Bryson just goes, I'm going to bite the reductio right here.
In the words of C.S. Lewis, he's not a tame lion.
Okay. Of course we have someone.
But he's good. Uh-huh. But is Paul good?
My two thoughts came into my mind. One of them is with Bryson. I'm like, Christians agree that basically all other Messiah figures are dangerous, like, but Jesus. Like, yes, religion outside of the truth is a tool and for manipulation, you know, and we see that in Dune. We see that with Muhammad, we see that with Joseph Smith, you know, we see that with all other people.
Reference also, did you just make a reference to the latest Book in It episode with Mormonism?
perhaps in canon reference.
Hey guys, make sure to go check out the other podcast.
That's right, exactly.
412 Podcasting Network.
Wait, we talked about Mormonism?
You weren't on that episode. It was Bryson and I.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I was like, so I was there.
Good to know that Todd so heard it and he liked it.
Yeah.
Yesterday during math.
and you were like,
let it be known I got a 98. I could concentrate while listening to Bryson and Cooper talk about Holmes.
Okay. Our soothing tones.
We're 90% sure we're 90% sure that Todd only made that statement for Mrs. Truly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. okay. What I was going to say was, there's also an argument that sometimes atheists make, and it's dumb. It's like Christians are atheists about 99% of gods, but the one, you know. And I'm just an atheist for one more god than you are. So at the same time, are we speaking out of both sides of our mouths to say messiahs are dangerous but not Jesus? I don't think so. The truth is a powerful tool. And so when it is done right, it is powerful and beautiful and awesome. And yeah, he's not a tame lion. Bryson said Jesus is dangerous. He flips over tables. He, you know, speaks about those kind of things. But also, yeah, I mean, there is some truth to it. And in the sense of, we need to be careful about not being fanatics about certain things, you know. I don't know.
Do we think Frank Herbert meant? Yeah, what did he mean?
You're right.
Dangerous as in bad. He's saying cautionary tale.
Right. Yeah. I'm going to say here that he meant messiah figures can be very dangerous. So there's one line where Liet Kynes remembers something his dad told him, where he said, "There's no more dangerous."
You mean
dangerous
we're talking about the movie?
Okay. Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry. Gender swap. Yeah.
Dude, you need to respect those gender.
It's okay. Honestly, it was really annoying because it changed. Nothing happened. There was it's the same character. Anyway, yeah. The line
I
of like
I
nothing...
have no idea who you're talking about.
Yeah. Nothing.
Second
could...
wave feminism, guys.
God, can I finish the thing? I'm sorry. No worse thing could befall your people than a hero leading them. And so the question is, does he mean that to be a universal rule, or is it just a high probability of danger? I don't know. I think it's open to interpretation. I don't think that it's explicitly anti. I don't know. It may
be
open to interpretation.
He buys into everything, almost everything Saudi Arabian / Muslim in the book. He's going all out on this Muslim Messiah and what actually a Muslim Messiah could look like and how it would be very dangerous. And so, yeah, I don't know if he can really bring that back to Jesus and talk about who Jesus was. And well, I mean, we just need to look at what was the purpose of these different messiahs. What were they coming to bring? What was their goal here on earth? And Jesus, yes, his goal was to, he was going to separate families. He was going to divide brother from sister. He was going to, tear apart some things, but he was building something better, something that was going to restore and in the end was going to be a whole lot more fulfilling and comforting than what was in place. And on top of that, he wasn't exactly what the Jews of his time thought he was going to be, who they thought the Messiah was going to be.
Right.
And in this book, I don't know if he exactly follows who the Fremen think the Messiah is going to be. Do they think that he's going to be someone that is going to overthrow all their enemies and tear down those that are seeking to harvest all of the spice trade?
Yeah, I mean, okay, here's another way to put what I'm trying to say. I think that the truth of something is very potent. And so even when you're wrong about something, but you're closer to the truth, that can honestly have great effects for harm, you know? So the Messiah, we keep seeing messiahs, they keep working because something about us wants a Messiah, right? Yeah. And so because we want a Messiah, then we understand that either that can be used for great harm or it can be used for a great, actual true power, you know?
Okay. I'm going to tie that back in to the story just a little bit.
Okay, I thought Tanner was flipping through the Bible for a while there. No, it was just Dune.
It was Dune.
It was Dune.
Oh, that's such a good copy. I wish I had that. Wow.
It's a good copy.
Me and Cooper have the exact same copy. There's one flaw. The text on the spine is the wrong way. It's very annoying. Okay, here's the deal. Okay, when we're talking about messiahs and our need for a messiah, In context of Dune, even they, like the Bene Gesserit specifically, had an understanding that everybody wanted a Messiah. And here's where the two things get really misconstrued, and what we have like a big contention in the book, right? In the book, the Bene Gesserit, and even in the movie, it's like they set up this religion to place hope in the minds of the Fremen. And
Paul says, that's not hope!
In the, exactly.
The second one, yeah.
In the movie, yeah. But not in the book. I agree with him, but
such a powerful line. Okay,
it's a cool part. Let's talk about that. Part.
So in the book, like it is really ambiguous. Okay, I really like when I was reading that section after the movie, I was trying to pay super hard attention to, is it just a fake religion or is it real? So obviously the Kwisatz Haderach is real. And that's something they're all driving for. But is the religion of the Fremen, is that fake? And so it seemed to be that it was a combination of things. Like, it was left vague on purpose, but the Bene Gesserit had been there implanting myths, like, hundreds of years previous, just in case, like, a Bene Gesserit got trapped on Arrakis, she could have an out, like, an easy way to gain power, you know, get on her feet again. So, but also, it seems like it was implied that Paul and Jessica just kind of, like, it just kind of went its own way, you know? Like, it just kind of morphed into something completely new and different. And so, like, it seems to be, like, obviously not a true religion, but also not just pure Bene Gesserit propaganda at the same time.
Exactly. And that kind of leads to talking a little bit more about the Messiah point again, as we're thinking about, like, was Paul actually supposed to be a Messiah gone dark, right? Or, like, like I understand that was Frank Herbert's intention, right? But, like, in the book and in the movie, was he a Messiah turned dark? And I think that the biggest
I think we all agree on that point. But the question also is, could he have avoided that, or was there another way?
Could he have avoided that? Yeah. And here's where I think we have to land, okay? The Quidditch Haderach is not a religious figure as much.
Right.
More like a fact of science that has been discovered by the Bene Gesserit.
It's a form of power this world has not yet seen.
Exactly.
And it's even like the Revenant. Dune is very like it's very humanist in that regard. Like this is the product, this is the man. Like this is the power of man being celebrated, you know,
exactly.
In Dune and in this person. Yeah.
And so we have that, right? We have this purely scientific figure, and we have Paul who is trying to supposedly, quote unquote, try and save as many people as he can, right? Because in every path that he looks down, just imagining Dr. Strange just sitting there, I flipped through trillions of options. And I found one, you know,
or,
like,
and the house should have ended 7.
14 trillion.
No.
How many do we win? 7.
Paul lands is he's like, I only see one path. And this one path is not a path of like where everybody gets to live and everybody's happy. Right. Like, there's not a perfect way to do this. Somebody is going to get hurt because we got thrown down this path by the Emperor, right? Like, we're too far down this path to have this happen, right? We have to make the most of it, right?
Yeah.
Because think about it this way, okay? Something that is implied in the book and not necessarily implied in the movie, but still, like, beneficial for our discussion that's happening right here. The Fremen had a whole lot of power against the Empire as a whole. And all they needed to do was be empowered by somebody, right? And it was only a matter of time before a great house or somebody with power found them and empowered them for something, right? Like, you already saw that there were myths and, talking about, like, the Sardaukar, right? Like, they were hardened fighting machines that came out of a harsh planet environment like Arrakis, though not specifically Arrakis, right? The Fremen in the book were like considered to be on par with the Emperor's own guard, like the Sardaukar that you see in the movie, right? And these two groups, right, they both had so much power. And all the Fremen needed was guidance, in the same way that all the Sardaukar needed and had already was guidance. So as we're looking at the book, Paul understood that the Fremen were just a lit keg. Like the fuse was on there, and all they were waiting for was just, you know, the right person to come and toss it at an enemy. Right.
Yeah. So you're saying, like, if he hadn't done anything, there was probably going to be someone else that was going to come along and that was going to light that fuse.
It's implied in the book, or from my understanding, okay. that's kind of implied in the book.
One of the reasons that the Emperor, like, tried to wipe out the Atreides in the book was because he thought that, you know, the men that Duncan and Gurney had trained were actually pretty close to being as good as Sardaukar. And he didn't like that a lot. But then, like, yeah. you know, Leto saw, as in the movie portrayed, these Fremen can be a fighting force that no one's ever seen before. So
exactly. Anyways, so what I'm trying to get at here is that, or I took way too long explaining that. Anyways, death was going to happen, and there was going to be a significant amount of death, whether he liked it or not. In the book, like even in the first part, like in the first part of the book, the first half, towards the second quarter, he talked a lot about this jihad that he talked about in the movies.
Holy war.
The holy war. Yeah. He called it a jihad as well. I mean, it doesn't really matter. Jihad, holy war.
Make it like, from the fact they have
I think
to
it's jihad.
That for...
I don't know. That's just how I read it.
It's jihad.
Nonetheless, yeah. Chaney. Like he, every path that he saw, like from his viewpoint, right? The fragments of the future that he saw a holy war in which there was mass famine, mass starvation. Like even in the movies, in the books, in the movies, right? He's seeing like. People are going to die, and they're going to die like huge amounts of death, right? And so he is stuck with the fact that no matter what he chooses, it almost feels like from his point of view, there's going to be hundreds of people that die. And so like, as we're thinking about this and we're like, did he, y'all are all laughing.
You said you're going to die lots of death.
It's just huge amounts of death. They're going to die huge amounts of death.
Hundreds. Just hundreds of people in the whole galaxy. You're going to die huge amounts of death.
I was laughing because I thought Todd was laughing.
I couldn't. The huge amounts of die huge amounts of death. No. No.
Y'all were laughing so hard I got distracted.
Continue. So the huge amounts of death got me. Dying huge amounts of death.
From Paul's point of view, right, and as we're talking about him, if he's a dark messiah or not, he was legitimately trying to find the best option out of everything. To be able to, like, no matter what, the Fremen were a lit keg, and they were going to blow. And they had all of the ammunition ready to start a holy war and the means to be able to, you know, wipe out the galaxy. So there's that. So what was he going to do?
That
kind of
goes into, was it too easy? You know,
honestly,
the Fremen were kind of
overpowered. Was he actually leading them, or what? Was he actually what they needed?
Okay, well, let's get to that. Okay, so here's real fast. We'll get to that later. Let's finish the Messiah discussion.
I'm gonna talk about the Messiah discussion. So I'm gonna tie it back in. So we've established that the Fremen are a lit fuse, right, and they're ready to blow. Paul comes in and the Atreides comes in, and here's where everything starts to get interesting, right? Paul is able to see fragments of the future, and his fragments of the future show him that certain things, like that people are going to die no matter what he chooses, all because of the Emperor sending them there to Arrakis. Now that they're there on Arrakis, and that the Harkonnens are, after the Harkonnens have killed everybody, and they're kind of on their own in the desert, Paul is looking at these, and it's kind of implied that he sees the Fremen as an untamed stallion that needs to be reined in, right? Like, they are ready to just be a stampede, ready to trample down the entire galaxy. And from Paul's point of view, being the Quidditch Haderach, he can see past
the blinders.
Are you
defending Paul here, then?
I'm defending what I understand from the book. From the first book, at least, right? Where he's not supposed to be a dark messiah.
Okay, it's a funny thing. First, he's supposed to be dark messiah from the beginning, but people missed that. And so when Doom Messiah comes along, people like hated it because they were like, where's the good Paul guy? He's all bad now. So it'll be interesting to see how they handle that in the movie.
I enjoyed Doom Messiah, for the record.
But okay, I think they set it up in this one well that
they
he's
did.
Not a good guy.
Right, right. So Bryson and Jack, we've been talking about the Ennead, you know, in our school. and on our podcast as well. I know, Jack, you wanted to kind of compare the Aeneid to this the storyline of, is it possible here for Paul to reject the kind of fate that's calling him? And also, is it his duty to reject fate? Did he submit to fate? I don't know. Do you have any Aeneid comparison / thoughts on Paul rejecting fate?
So this kind of goes to what Tanner was saying about how Paul sees that it's the, once he drinks the water of life, then he sees that is the only way forward. But then that also begs the question, did he need to drink the water of life?
Right.
So I guess where I land with that, as I'm playing devil's advocate over here, from Paul's perspective, is a good guy. He's already seeing fragments of the future, right?
Well, whether he likes the movie, if I go south, it all goes bad. I think that's what Jack's referring to here, right? Of like, did he?
Oh, you're talking about
my point of view. The Jedi are evil.
Okay, George Lucas, go away. Okay,
well, then you are lost.
So, Jack, what were you saying here? You're saying, like, did he need to go south? Did he need to drink the water in the first place? That kind of thing? Like, was it worth it?
Right. That's where it gets into the, I don't know, I'll tie into the Aeneid in a second. But it's, like, that choice, him choosing to go take the water of life, not necessarily his destiny, kind of more to the, I'm saying, hold with me here. That's the free will part. It's, like, he chooses to drink the water of life. That's not necessarily he doesn't necessarily have to do that. Like, that's where the exploiting the flaw that we talked about in a little while ago comes in, is he doesn't trust himself. So he always relies on other people and other methods. And because he doesn't do that and stick to his own morality and takes these other paths, then it sends him down not the right way. If he would have stuck to what his father had taught him, sure, he could harness, like, his father wanted to harness the desert power, but does there need to be a holy war across the galaxy? Like,
right,
should they just retake Arrakis? It ties into the Aeneid, because so in the Aeneid, you'll have to listen to specifically Aeneid part 2 if you want to understand this on the Book and It podcast. Is the madness fighting, like, and Aeneid proposes that everything that's against fate is madness,
right?
And because of that, that opposition to fate is madness, and opposition to fate is bad, and that needs to be avoided. So it ties in there, because people are convincing Paul, oh, this is what you have to be to become. This is what you had to become. And to not do that would be stupid, which is
so the question is, like, what is fate then?
Yeah, because if fate is what's going to happen, then what happens is fate. So you can never not be following fate. You can never go against fate.
I guess in fate, I feel like how it's talked about in the Aeneid, and how I feel like it also should be talked about here in Dune, is something that is. So in the Aeneid, it's divinely proclaimed that Aeneas will go to Italy and start the next Troy. That it's kind of more like a prophecy thing. Like, that's the destiny that you had to meet. Like, you need to get to this end point, and you will get to that. Or I don't know if it implies that.
No, it is, because there's so much about, like, the future of Rome that happens. You know, like, he's very much looking forward as he's carrying out his duties.
But that, I guess, it doesn't necessarily apply that it's like that needs to happen, but does it apply then that will happen? Like, whether Aeneas does.
Yeah, that's
it
a good point. Okay, so it seems
Todd, this will make a lot of sense Todd. To you.
I've been listening to the podcast. I'm cheating. Okay. I don't have to read it if I listen to the podcast.
Someone mind jogging my memory real fast. In the book, does it ever say that if he went, like, does anybody ever say that if he goes down to the south, that that's when the holy war will start?
That's, like, very much stressed in the movie more.
Okay, so basically everything that, like, happens in the movie is in the book, but, like, much less so in the book than in the movie. So, like, is there this idea of religious fervor leading to Paul? Is he going to claim that religious fervor or not? Is he concerned about that? Is he not? That's in the book. It's just toned way down. Also, he is the one, pretty much devoid of all other influence, who goes after the water of life. There's also not this like north-south dichotomy of north being, you know, liberal and south being fundamentalist, I guess, if you want to put it in modern evangelical terms, which is really dumb, by the way. I hate like, the word fundamentalist looking... appearing in a sci-fi movie. But
like, I've been looking through the book, and I don't see it as being a decision on whether he goes south to start, like, to start a holy war or not. It's really just, is he going to be able to see the entire future or not? From what I understand.
Okay, so let me put this into perspectives. What is Paul pursuing here? So Paul is pursuing, first and foremost, vengeance, I guess, right? Like, and the book and movie both portray this as good. Getting back the Harkonnens, kicking them off, kicking the oppressors off the land. That's good. Number two, there's also kind of like this sub-good of the Kwisatz Haderach, and it's unclear to me if Paul thinks that that is a good as well, or if it just is you know, he's destined to assume the mantle. So for me, going south is mostly a decision of, in order to beat the Harkonnens, I have to do that, but also I'm going to become the Kwisatz Haderach, and that means the Holy War is going to happen. I don't know. So at that point, it becomes... is there any other way to accomplish the goal of defeating the Harkonnens without becoming the Kwisatz Haderach, you know? And so, like, actually, like this, at the end of the book, Gurney is not the character he is in the movie. He is very much concerned about what Paul has become. Paul is like, okay, what about the spies? What about this? And Gurney's like, what about our men? Like, we're losing men. We need to be concerned about that first and foremost. Paul's no longer concerned about that. And so it seems to me that Paul, in the interest of getting back the Harkonnens and doing the right thing, needs to become the Kwisatz Haderach, and he knows that's going to carry with it a bunch of bad stuff. I'm not sure that comes across in the movie. I don't know. Any thoughts, guys?
My thought is we're supposed to end the Messiah discussion 25 minutes ago.
fair enough. Fair enough. Sorry.
Wait.
Don't worry, Todd. In like 2 minutes, we'll let you gush about
all the stuff.
Todd really wants to talk about Hans.
I just want to talk about the good parts of the movie.
Guys.
This is the good part. This is the good stuff.
We haven't even talked about Aaliyah yet and the waterfall effect.
Nah, she doesn't matter. She's barely in this.
Yeah. I know. Honestly, Tanner, you can do your like Tanner's rant thing. None of us like really care about Aaliyah.
Oh, that was...
I truly believe it's the only reason that the rest of that the movie...
I think it's a conspiracy theory. I think...
Okay.
That was one of my worries.
Okay, you know what?
Wait, finish the Messiah. Hold on.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Are we done with the Messiah? Anything?
No, hold on. I want to say.
Go ahead, Jack.
I think Bryson also has something to say. I could see him over there wanting to say something. But also, so to wrap it up, like what Cooper was saying, and also goes back to what Tanner was saying, is that it's the lit keg that they needed that figure to lead them. Like, was there another way to persuade them to fight them?
Also, there's this other good of like the Arrakis becoming a paradise too, which kind of implied in what you're saying of like Paul's going to lead the Fremen to paradise.
That's a part of my worries for the next movie. How are they going to do that?
Well, in the movie, no, you can't do it anymore. They destroyed the beautiful water source that they had. Yay. Just
go
blew
ahead,
it up and nobody cared. Sorry.
I think there, I don't know what it is, there had to have been another way that didn't involve, and then it wouldn't have been a corruption arc. It would have been a neutral arc, which means that he maintains his belief system and does not fall into the corruption. The corruption comes when he drinks the water of life.
But wait, what? Are we still
That's
talking
where
about
it's,
gaining vengeance as his end goal? Or what did we decide his end goal was? I forgot.
His motivation was to... Well, I think... Yeah, his motivation was, like Cooper said, was to get revenge on the Harkonnens and then also take as few lives as possible. And did he need the Water of Life to do that? Could he have just been a leader without these powers? Like, and then that would have been... Which is why the Chani's character is so important, because it's showing that perspective. It's like, do you actually need to do this?
Yeah, I guess a better way to put it, something that could dumb it down just a tad bit. Like, if we think... I'm not saying any right words today.
No, it's good. It's good.
You calling the audience dumb?
It's like, did... No. No, not at all. Did... If we think of Paul like the President of the United States, did he need the nuclear launch codes in order to be effective or not? Right? Did he need the U.S. military backing him, or would the President be okay to just be the President? You know, that's what the quid... Like, he's the Quijoc Chadarok whether he likes it or not. He's the President whether he likes it or not. Right? And yeah. So what are is he going to, I guess where I land with it is he going to have access to those nuclear launch codes? Is he going to have the nuclear football and have be our commander in chief? Yeah. Or is he going to remain a partially unlocked, you know, I can see bits and parts and I can lead us as a country, but I don't have any actual power that I can to be able to command.
I guess to summarize here, we've decided that it's a fall messiah arc. Probably there could have been avoided in some way, and so what is it? It's a fall arc.
But we don't necessarily know what that other
but,
way.
But it asked the movie just kind of like asked the question. Yeah, we don't know. We don't
had to be another way.
Had to be something. We're just sad. That's the whole point, is we're sad.
I have a historical relation, but I'm not going to talk about it because time.
Yes, okay. Todd, you've been sitting silently and fidgeting in your seat, dying much death. Please gush about the score, visual effects, all you want to talk about, man.
So if you look at my...
Notes. You pull up your notes
right now? Okay. If you look at my Spotify right now, but you can't actually, but on my personal profile, when you go to top songs this month, the top 20 are the soundtrack for this film. The first film...
Wow.
Yeah, the first film...
Keep in mind, he only listens to score music.
Keep in mind, I have these headphones that I use for my piano that, like, shake when you listen to this score on max volume. I have lost hearing, but it's so worth it when you're listening to a score like this. And the score for the first film was... which shook the IMAX room as it does in the second movie. And I watched this movie a second time in a regular theater, and it still shook the room. It was still a great experience. But it has, like, a distinct sound that you can't quite, like, what even is that instrument? And I watched a couple interviews, and I saw that he went to Home Depot and... made instruments that didn't exist out of ancient instruments. So he used, like, the flute sounds aren't really a flute, it's some ancient instrument. I tried to recreate some of the songs from it, but couldn't find the instrument because he just created sounds that were otherworldly but sounded ancient, which was perfect for the movie. And I think he took the criticisms from the last film, maybe that was too much, toned it down.
Yeah,
it's
definitely less bombastic. Yeah,
brought his A game as he always does, as like the lead composer of our time. Just
whoa, high praise.
He is. You can't really disagree with that. Him, yeah.
I mean, he's the most prominent for sure.
Him, yeah. Those two are really making the most. Good music in our day.
Making the most waves. So,
yeah.
Let me ask you this, Todd. So, what, like, you're saying it's great. What, like, if you had to put your finger on it, what makes it great? Yeah. Like, what makes this score great?
Because there's no other, it fits the tonal look of the film and the story. Like Paul's new theme, the bombastic horns for him, like the evil bad messiah theme, is the one that sticks out to me. Why it's so good is because it's unlike any soundtrack you've ever heard before. Like I said, there's instruments that haven't existed before, plus ancient instruments you don't regularly hear. And the... I also play a couple of the songs on the piano, and he uses a scale that didn't exist either. So
that's pretty wild.
Basically, yeah, So yeah, he can bind two scales and made a Arab sounding scale that hadn't been played before. And then all the songs are in that scale.
So what I'm hearing is it's great when it comes to world building. And you know what world building makes me think of? The climax, transition.
Yes, Jack. Nice. Mm-hmm. That's all you're going to say for the score, Todd.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, world building. Mm-hmm.
Okay, guys.
It definitely helped. It sold for me, Paul and Shawnee's love story. It sold the intimidatingness of Fade Rotha, and then the change from, dude, this guy is bad news for Paul Atreides.
Yeah.
For me, it sold a lot of the things in the movie.
Oh yeah,
along with the cinematography.
It can definitely help. I do think one of the reasons I like this score better is the romance theme. I think it works better.
It's a theme from film that, yeah, the Armada theme, the theme that the Atreides that they played on the bagpipes, theme, it's that theme slowed down.
Oh, nice. That's cool. That's cool. I think that scene of them on the dune and then the sweeping camera work, then the action. By the way, the action was great. The first crawler attack was awesome.
So crazy. The action was the world so ride, great. The Harkonnen Arena.
So good. And IMAX, bro. Oh, yeah.
Oh, the Hark. You cannot get better visual effects than the Hark.
Oh, that's my one.
Than Getty Prime. Getty Prime was gold.
Dude,
I have no idea.
Getty Prime is the Harkonnen planet.
It's the planet they go
to. That's the only problem with the VFX, actually. Look closely at the crowd the next time you look at it. It's the same spot composited over and over.
Yeah, okay, fair.
Because they're all doing the same thing and they all look the same. I noticed it for
sure.
It's
like a Madden crowd.
Time. But yeah.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about the climax. There are multiple threads here. We have the guild climax. We have the, was it too easy for them to like route the Sardaukar? We have the Chani and Irulan thing going on. We have the spice. We have the Lanzarat, all those things. So how was the climax for you guys? Did it work? Did you feel tension? Bryson, what were you feeling during the climax?
Oh, I think we lost him.
Bryson, we can't hear you, man.
Tanner, tell us about that climax while we wait.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yes, yes, the climax. This was the thing I had the biggest problem with walking out of it, watching it the first time with Bryson, despite the fact that that was the second time. Like, I was not sold, okay? So we get into the room, right? He's called everybody up there. We're in the really cool room. We've got Chani there. We've got everybody. We've got all the key central players in there, including Princess Irulan, the Bene Gesserits, and the Emperor, and Chani, and all of the Fremen. And so we're just kind of watching to see, like, what's happening with all of these characters, and, like, what's happening right here, right? We know we're all in the final home stretch, and I'm watching this, and I'm like, how is this going to play out? What are they going to do here? Like, because the thing I remember most about the book, my favorite part, was specifically the climax. Like, that final part, like, the entire book had just been set up so well to lead to that climax, and just in essence Paul saying, I have control over the entire empire, whether you like it or not, so you can give me what I want or you can all die in little isolated planets. Right. That's kind of what he says. Like, that's the essence of the climax in the book. So that's what I'm looking for as I'm going into this final scene. I'm like, I'm ready to have some more dialogue parts, and I'm ready to see him drive this sucker home and just give me an amazing movie. And it failed. The first time, at least. And here's why I think why. The entire movie, we've been told Melange or Spice, the all-seeing drug, it's valuable. But we're never told why it's valuable, except for one time in the very first movie where they say that Melange allows people to be able to see into the future for short periods of time. And that's how the Spacing Guild is able to do that. And they have one very specific section in the first part where they talk about that. Well, throughout the rest of the movie, and specifically in part two, the number one thing that we see there is that Melange and Spice is basically just money. It's like an economy in and of itself. It's cash flow. And nobody else really has like control of this cash flow if they don't have Arrakis, right? And so if we're looking at this, what I was looking for from the movie was I wanted them to show me why Melange mattered. And because they were unable to show me why I should care about Spice, why Spice was important, why it's important that, you know, Paul could just nuke it all out and blow it all up, you know, they failed to show me why I should care at all about the little fight scene that happened between Fadrotha and Paul. It just felt kind of, oh, look, we can fight. Yay. Paul wins, we win. The movie's over if Paul beats Fadrotha. No, it's not what the book was about. That's not what the climax was supposed to be. The climax was supposed to be this idea of Paul has control over the entire production of Spice, and therefore the connection between planets for the Spacing Guild. And so if Paul is able to destroy all of the Spice, then the Spacing Guild can do nothing. And everybody dies in little isolated planets, pockets of planets, alone. And obviously, that's bad for everybody. Empire doesn't like that. Bene Gesserits don't like that. Spacing Guild doesn't like that. So they are all trying to prevent Paul from just nuking everything. So Paul has to deal with that in the final part. Somebody else talk.
Let me hit you with my non-book read observation. With that information that you've just given me, unbeknownst to me, having not read the book, I see where you're coming from. And I see where that's totally missed. But I also see, looking at the film, it's like, God, that would have been so much more world building that people probably would have complained about. That's the first thing. I don't think people would have liked it. I mean, I love a good world build. I think for me, having not read the book, the climax to me is, which I understand is the wrong perspective if you're looking from the book perspective. But from my perspective, it's they're just preventing Paul from getting power, like, over them. They just don't want him to be emperor. And then I think the climax for me resolves enough to be like, all right, we have all the story threads. We have something to look forward to next time. The bad guys failed at not giving the Fremen and Paul power. It's kind of just like we're trying to step on the Emperor's toes and the other house's toes. Take revenge and take – it was really about taking the power, not necessarily about the spice and whether – who will be disconnected or not.
Yeah.
I think they did well, in my opinion.
I guess – okay. Yeah, I see that. So I guess where I just came into it the first time, because I'm about to explain, I don't align with those views entirely anymore. Like, I do think that it holds up very well on its own after watching it the second time. But, like, from the first time watching it, I knew it was all about the power in the climax, right? I knew that I wasn't looking for, like, you know, I knew what I was looking for. I was looking for the power plays that were going to happen there. And I guess what just was a little bit disappointing to me the first time was I'm watching this, and like you just said, it's all about, like, it was about stepping on their toes, right? And from what I had already read and what I had thought this was leading up to was not stepping on somebody's toes, more like walking up to them with a sawed-off shotgun and saying, hand me everything you have, right? Because that's what happened in the book. And so I'm walking into this expecting Paul to just be this absolute monster and, you know, just, you know, RKO this entire, you know, the entire empire just single-handedly. but you know, I didn't really get that.
Okay, so
or I didn't get that in the way that I thought I was going to.
Okay, so by the way, two things. I have Bryson here on my phone with me, so whenever he wants to jump in, he can just let me know, and I'll put my phone to the microphone. So he's back. But also, I think that so the first time I agree with Jack, I think it works on a level of like the good guys win, the bad guys don't. Like on that simple level, it's fun.
The kind of good guys.
The good guy. Yeah, fair. I'm sorry. You're right. Pursuant to our discussion,
less than bad guys. The other guys are more bad than them. So
right. The guys that don't want everybody. The to
people
die,
that aren't pale white and dressed in black. Those guys mm-hmm. won. Mm-hmm. But then I think I agree with Tanner on the second rewatch. It wasn't as tense as it could have been, how we fully understood what was going on. I think all the pieces were there. But I still think it works. Like it's a fun climax. The Fade Rotha scene is awesome. Like they're obviously being set up as foils, you know. Fade Rotha's a cool bad guy. Seeing Paul dispatch him was awesome.
Quidditch Haderach candidates.
Right, exactly. Candidates for the breeding program. I was going to say, Todd, why don't you talk about for a minute here, like Chani and the climax. Like, do you feel like it worked, her relationship to the climax? Were you getting more annoyed with Chani? Were you on Chani's side? The scene with Irulan where she like stood up, that kind of thing. Your thoughts. We end with Chani. You know, the final shot is Chani. Like, what does
that
say?
So I agree with you and Jack on the way that just the movie by itself stands alone. But my worry comes in having read the book with the context that is not in the movie. That in the book, Chani and Paul kind of really makes Chani understand that this decision to marry Irulan is only a political decision. You're still my one true love.
Right, and it kind of parallels Jessica and Leto.
Yeah.
Little bit.
So I was a little... So the book ends abruptly, right? Even more abruptly than this does. Than the movie does. But the movie still kind of ends abruptly too. And I watched an interview. Villeneuve said he wanted to end it the same way the book did. After reading this, this is just a criticism of the story. I didn't like that it ended abruptly. And then this goes into more of, was it too easy? Paul's journey. Did him and the Fremen taking down... Let's not forget, though, that it was epic, though. Them taking it down.
Yeah, I mean, it looks so cool, man.
Who cares if it was too easy? Because that was like one of the coolest things I've seen in a movie. Like, it reminded me of... just, I don't know, Lord of the Rings, taken like the in Two Towers when Gandalf and the Rohirrim come in.
Bryson, say that again.
Pure genius. First time I actually loved it. Like, I haven't seen a movie like that with special effects as incredible as that in forever.
Yep. Mm-hmm. But I think maybe that's just a weak point for the story. On Frank Herbert's part, just ending it like that, ending it so abruptly, and things being too easy. But that's just me. I felt unsatisfied when I read the book that way. And then, after watching the movie, I kind of felt okay with it because the book ended that way. But now I'm thinking, it's not okay either when the book ends it. I'm not okay with it, how the book ends and how the movie ends. Abruptly.
Yeah.
Knows Chani better? I mean...
No, I think it's an interesting take to make Chani go off on her own away from Paul. It drives in more the fact that Paul is not who Chani thought he was, or he has now had a drastic change. And I think it sets up what the director could do in the third movie better than what the book put off. Like, Chani wasn't that phased in the book.
No, she was not at all. Yeah. I think that like I just want to say like it's a little overplayed, and just her drama. Like I said, I didn't buy Chani Will Come to Believe. I didn't buy that. But at the same time, if your lover becomes this megalomaniac who's like in power, I'd be a little scared, you know. So I think they tried to reflect that well enough. Yeah, I agree with you there.
Hey, I don't know. Zendaya is quite the drama queen, anyway.
I know you want to say something, Tanner, but let me just real fast. The fact that, because for me, Chani is trying to make sure Paul does not enter that corruption arc. Like, Chani is the last resort that Paul can rely on to not enter the corruption arc. But he ignores what Chani's telling him because he thinks it's for Chani's better good. And so it leads to the corruption arc. So I think it's great to show her going off because she wouldn't agree.
Yeah, see, I still agree that that's a better way to take that.
I agree. So here's my thing. I think that the movie is less nuanced than the book. It's much more like Paul is bad, pretty much, and he assumes this responsibility. In the book, he's kind of more neutral. It happens to him. He's not radically shifting bad, and Chani just kind of goes along with it. But in the movie, like you said, Todd, it's probably better and clearer to have what happens to Paul happen. And so I think you're right, Jack. You're convincing me that Chani was played right in terms of she's the moral center. She has to be the one, saying no to Paul and kind of ground us as we're looking at the change that's happening. So I agree with you. The movie they made, which is less nuanced and more clear,
Denis is looking at the big picture. Because if he didn't do that and then had Dune Messiah, it would be just as surprising as how the audience readers reacted to Dune Messiah.
Yeah. All right. So Tanner, you talk, and then we'll do some concluding thoughts.
I have two things that I want to say, as well as balloons that are popping up on my screen for everybody else. I originally did not like that Chaney and
Princess Irulan were standing at the end.
Okay.
On Chani, Arrakis.
I am dying right now, guys. This is Chani and Princess Irulan. Did not like that they were both standing originally. Okay. Didn't really see what was happening there. Did not like the plays that were happening. Like, I was like, oh my gosh, what are we doing here, guys? Didn't like that the first time. Second time, loved it because it just set up so well. Like, it set up so well for if he wanted to do a part three. It really expressed the dichotomy between the three of them, the power struggle that's happening between all three of them, like, at that time. And it's just kind of like a beautiful visual representation of that.
Yeah.
So that's my one thing. My second really big thing that I never got to talk about in this and won't for y'all's ears. But I will be doing something talking about Aaliyah. And for those of you that don't know, Aaliyah is Paul's younger sister who was inside of Jessica for like the entire movie.
Pro-life moment.
Yes, pro-life moment. Did not like that she had not been developed for the longest time. Saw a lot of problems in the movie because she wasn't, like, she hadn't come out. Felt like a major character development flaw. All things teasing to the waterfall effect that I will talk about in a Tanner's rant later on about awesome. Why I think Aaliyah was such an interesting play by Villeneuve.
Someone isolate that, please. Okay. All right.
Anyways.
Not even.
Yeah.
Those are my two things.
All right. One thing to add. I think that the book adds this element of bittersweet because Paul and Chani have a kid and that kid dies like in the raid on Siege Tabra, which happens simultaneously with the climax. So the raid takes place with the climax. So it's kind of like this bittersweet element. I think balances out they won too easily kind of
thing.
Yeah,
they had the perfect chance to introduce.
I know they did. Okay, Jack, you did not like the first movie. You liked the second movie. In 1 minute, one of my friends, our mutual friend, she said, I didn't like this movie because I didn't know what I was supposed to take away from it. So what would you say to someone like that What can you take away from this movie, and why does it make the movie worth watching? And so that's even better than the first one. What'd you say? 1 minute.
So I think that's where the – so what's redeeming about Dune? It's what's the truth, goodness, and beauty thing, right? It's beauty because it's – I mean, the film is beautiful. A piece of art. Everyone knows it. But the truth that's in it, I feel like, is it's a cautionary tale not about the risks of a messiah. For me, it's a cautionary tale about taking advantage of people. And I can't read my own handwriting. What happens when you lose that morality that Paul loses in becoming the Messiah? And what happens when people prey on other people's flaws? Like, that's the cautionary tale to me. And why I think Paul's character is phenomenal. Why I think Lady Jessica's character is phenomenal. And why the whole story works. I still kind of don't like the first film. But you need the first film, like, obviously.
Yeah.
But I still don't like the first film. But second one's great. Fun time.
Awesome. That's a really good take. Bryson, how about you? What would you say? 1 minute take. Why should someone like this movie?
Yeah, exactly. They have... this is so... I can't listen to myself. They should be taking out of it that, yeah, when he stopped following what he knew was right and started listening to all of these other influences with, okay, what's going to happen later on? How is this going to affect the Holy War? How is this going to affect the Fremen? He's no longer listening to the voice of truth, and he's now listening to this idea of, okay, how am I going to best fulfill this destiny? How am I going to best be the Messiah that they need and they want, and really just in the end, how am I going to satisfy myself and what I want to accomplish instead of what actually needs to be done for his world, for the people that he is supposed to be protecting.
Gotcha. All right, Todd, you got like 30 seconds. What'd you say?
I'd say that with fall arcs in stories, we know as Christians that we were fallen, but we also had redemption. So what we get from fall arcs is the, and a story like Dune, of Paul, this figure who we knew, now know to be a fallen person. It reminds us of the redemption that we have. And also, go see the movie because it's an experience.
It is an experience. Thank you guys for listening. Hope you had a fun experience. Tanner will share his thoughts on his Tanner rant. My thoughts are, it's a great movie. It's bigger. It's better than his first movie. Even if the first one is like more tonally consistent. So, love you guys. Thanks for listening. Hope you guys had fun. This movie is good for all the reasons just mentioned. Bye. This has been The Screening.